It is Wednesday, April the 8th. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I'm your host, Eddie Lindenstein. Thank you for being here. Let's bring an old show guest back. Why don't we? Welcome back to the Mind and Fitness Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Eddie Lindenstein. Again, I am still in Japan as you listen to this. I'm somewhere in Kyoto at the moment. And a few days ago, I would have attended a professional baseball game in the Tokyo Dome in front of a sold out crowd. And I'm so pumped for that. And it's weird because I'm speaking into the future 2 weeks from now as I record this, but also something happened a few days ago. So nevertheless, back on the show, I can't recall if this is her third appearance. But Lisa Schlossberg, the Out of the Cave podcast, it's one of my favorites, is back here. We're talking a lot about like intentional weight loss. That's like the primary mover for this particular conversation. Let's take a listen to Lisa and I from the Out of the Cave podcast. Welcome back to the Mind and Fitness podcast. I'm your host, Eddie Lindenstein. One of my favorites is back, and I can't remember if this is the third or fourth appearance, but Lisa Schlossberg is back. Thank you for being here.
Yay. Thank you for having me.
And I know I'm sure this is going to come up at some point, but it's not a vocalized pause. Let me get that out of the way right away. But there's a certain phrase that you say, and every once in a while I'll shoot you a text message and I'll say, hey, I said this today and it made me think of you. How's it going? But it's, you know, thank you for sharing that. I love it. And I've listened to so many interviews that you've done. And so it's always a good time. So I'm happy that you're back in New York. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
And when I first met you, you were a San Diego person, or at least Southern California, I think. And then you moved to to the worst coast, because I'm a Tupac person, and suddenly you're like a Biggie Smalls Nas person. But when did you move, by the way? I can't remember if we've done an interview since you moved. I feel like we have, but when did that happen?
I don't know if we've done one since I moved, but to back up, I am from New York. I'm born and raised New York.
I didn't know that.
To go out to California. Yeah, yeah. And some people don't, you know, it depends when I meet people. But so I was living in California for like 5 years. I was in Orange County for a few, and then I was in San Diego for a few. And now I'm back in New York for a couple of years now, and I'm living in Brooklyn.
Okay, cool. Man, that is badass. Okay. Well, we were there. Our family went there last year, and I had asked you, because we're going to talk about this in a second, but you were flying back from Texas recently, and I had asked you, do you just hear that Alicia Keys Empire State of Mind Part 2 song playing in your head as the plane is landing? Because we went there as a family last year, and it was actually right about this time last year, and we did this boat tour on the Hudson, and I think they only played the song once, but my daughters were just singing that song nonstop for the entire trip. Didn't matter if we were on Wall Street or like wherever it was that we went. Concrete jungle, yeah. With dreams of
it is the anthem, yeah. While you're here, yeah. For sure. It should be.
Well, I'll say like, this is going to be tough to explain, but in Seattle, it's not that we have an amazing depth of musical history. Basically, grunge began here. Nirvana was here. So like there's all these bands that are here. Jimi Hendrix was from here. So there's a lot of depth. However, not that I can recall, are there any artists aside from Macklemore? And I mean, who's the guy that did Baby Got Back? What's the name of that guy? It's who's the dude? And he's out here for everything too. He's always anyway. It was a rapper from the 80s or the 90s. But anyway, there's not really any artists here besides Macklemore that speak a lot about their love for the city. And it's not that we don't have.
Sir makes a lot.
Yeah, that's what. Okay, that's who it is. Perfect. Thank you. He comes out to every friggin' sporting event, and I don't know how I didn't remember that. Hopefully, nobody in Seattle's listening to this. But it's almost as if there's not like a lot of pride about Seattle. But as when we were walking around New York, I just kept feeling like it is like these people are proud to be New Yorkers. It's a piece of it. I guess touch on that. That has nothing to do with what the main thing we're going to talk about today is. But that was what I walked away from New York feeling, was like people love being from here. They love it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I can't speak obviously for every New Yorker, but I think there's something very real about that. And, you know, over the winter, especially, like, I really struggled coming back for the winters, having lived in Southern California. But I really am at a point where I totally get why it's like, this is a bad world. Like, it is, that's what it feels like. And what I find interesting now that I live actually in the city, I grew up on Long Island, so like not nearly as fun or cool, but now I live in Brooklyn, and it's like people in Brooklyn have a lot of Brooklyn pride, not just like New York pride, but like Brooklyn pride specifically. And then I have friends that live in Queens, and there's like a lot of Queens pride specifically too. And not that they're, you know, at odds with each other or whatever, but I do think that there is a lot of just like New York pride for where we're from.
Even specific to the boroughs. That's interesting. Cause we don't have, Seattle's not big enough to have, to have that.
Right.
The thing that struck me, I mean, I went there as a little kid, but then didn't go back until, you know, last year as a 39-year-old. And the distinctive difference of being on the subway traveling 25 minutes and it's like you're on a, it's like you're in a different country. Everything felt totally different from one place to the next. And that's like a really interesting experience. And we leave for Tokyo on Sunday, and Tokyo is the, it's either the largest city in the world or the most populous city in the world. And I think it's going to feel like that too. We're going to get on the subway. We're going to ride for 20 minutes, and then it's going to feel like we're on an entirely different place. Like, I think there's like five or six like sub cities within Tokyo itself.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Yeah. I'm very curious to hear how that goes for you.
Yeah. I am too. Cool. Not looking forward to the time change, but everything else there's a tech creator who I follow who I really, really like. She's there right now, and she posted this morning about how good she had chicken sashimi for dinner last night. I don't know if I can do it, if I'm being real.
When in Rome, when in Tokyo, you totally can do it. I was going to say, if you're looking forward to anything, let it be the sushi.
Well, it's going to be the food, but I don't know if I can do the, like, it was grazed with a torch for 3 seconds. Yeah. But yeah, the raw chicken, I just like, supposedly it's very safe and it's a delicacy. And that's one thing, like when I talk to the kids, especially if we're going to travel, especially international, you have to have the local cuisine. And we also, even though if it seems weird to us, it's not weird elsewhere. And there is some racist undertones that you don't even intend. You know what I mean? Like, and I don't know if you watch the show Survivor at all, but we're Survivor people. Years ago, and I think they probably stopped doing this 15 years ago, they would have what they called the Icky Food Challenge. And they used to record these seasons all throughout the world. They've done it exclusively in Fiji for 10 or 12 years now. But prior to that, it'd be like, we're doing Survivor China, we're doing Survivor Australia, we're doing, you know, Survivor Patagonia. Like, we're doing it in specific places. And part of that would be, we're going to challenge each other, and, you know, like, last person eliminated wins, of who can stomach eating this icky food. But it was always the local delicacies. And as I got older, I remember thinking, like, that doesn't seem okay. I get it. Like, you know, it makes for good commercials and good social media and stuff like that. But I don't know. Food's funny, which is, we're going to get into that today. So, what took you to Texas for a month?
The winter in New York is what pushed me to go to Texas for a month. So when I moved back here to New York after being in California, the winter sucks. I love New York, but the winter sucks, and I don't thrive in the winter at all. So after the last year, I made a promise to myself basically at the end of last year that I was not going to be here for the entire, or not, I wasn't going to be here for the entirety of the winter. I was going to find a way to escape at least part of it. So that's what got me to do Texas. I love Austin. I've been there many times. I have really good friends there. Long story short, because the details don't matter, that's why I was in Austin for what ended up being a total of 6 weeks. It wasn't necessarily intended to be that long, one-way ticket. And I was able to stay very fortunately at a friend's apartment in her empty bedroom. So I did that. I had a retreat over in California. So I spent a few weeks in Austin. I went over to San Diego for about 2 weeks to see my friends there, stay there for a while, have my retreat out there. And then I went back to Austin. And now I'm back in New York.
This was a Lisa Schlossberg hosted retreat, or this was one you were attending?
Yeah. This was a Lisa Schlossberg hosted retreat.
Okay, tell me about it. What are we doing at this? How large is the audience? Who's the audience?
Okay, so this particular event was just open to my alumni. Mm-hmm. I've had this retreat house in Encinitas since last few years. So it was really easy for me to do. I just kind of carbon copied all the details of what we've done in the past. And so it's your house. It's like a 2-minute walk from the beach. But that's why it's alumni only. It's like a really kind of intimate shared space. So there were, I think, 9 or 10 participants this year at this house. And I had a few guest instructors come and we just kind of did our thing. So it was a quick Friday evening, all day Saturday, all day Sunday. And then we checked out and went home on Monday.
Excellent. Well, when I think of Texas, I don't think of you, but Austin seems like it's almost like a little warm New York within the state of Texas. Is that accurate?
Yes. It honestly always, I mean, I can't say I'm by any stretch an expert on Texas as a state, but yeah. It feels like Austin is like its own planet.
Yeah.
Like it's really its own thing.
Yeah.
I love it there. Yeah. I think I'm in the middle of like the existential crisis of, do I need to move there? But we'll come back to that another time.
You know what? Every time we go to California, actually, I have that. And then I'm reminded, like anytime that, once I'm there for, I mean, it depends on the time of year, but when we go in like June, July, August, it typically only takes me, I don't know, 2 days in that heat before I'm like, my Pacific Northwest. And right. Like you're sort of in the same, I think, midst of it probably with New York weather and how all that goes. So, okay. There's been a series of podcasts recently that have caught my attention that you've done. You have your own podcast. Actually, before we get into that, tell us about your podcast. So I think it's great. I think you have a real knack for interviewing. Talk about it. What's it called?
Thank you.
Where can people find it? What's the mission of it, the thesis of it?
Yeah. Okay, great. So it's called the Out of the Cave Podcast with Lisa Schlossberg. It's on Spotify and Apple and probably everywhere else you can find podcasts. And it really is for anyone who is navigating the relationship we have with food. So I think the best way that I can put it is something you've heard me say over and over again. You are a spiritual being having a physical experience with an animal brain in a social context surviving on food. So there's a lot to unpack. There's a lot to understand. And there's a lot we have to navigate on a daily basis. And so my podcast is intended to be a free resource for ultimately every human being that wants to know how to do this in a way that can feel really stable and peaceful and healthy and free. And that requires a lot of unlearning and relearning. And that's really what the podcast is dedicated to supporting people with.
So some of these statements may come off as taboo the way that I ask them. So just work with me here. We have I've said quite a few times, even on episodes that you're not on of this, that sort of your background and your schooling and the way your career has gone, like that is me to a T. Like if I could just wave a magic wand, like that's pretty much, if I can't be like a pro wrestling writer, like that's pretty much what I would want to do is all the intersections of your background that you have. When I hear you talk about what the genesis of the thought behind your podcast and what you do began with, the nuance that comes to mind for me is diet culture has taken this interesting turn, I feel like. And for a long time, like in, you know, the 90s and the 2000s, and this is kind of a trend on social media right now where like, what was the ideal body in the 90s and the 2000s and, you know, 80s and probably the 70s and things like that too. When I hear you speak about what, you know, I think of like, she's talking about intuitive eating. How does that really intersect with dieting or people, you know, wanting to lose weight or have a background in losing weight or whatever? And you've done this recent series on like intentional weight loss. To me, those things feel like they are in conflict. Can you talk about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, okay. When I'm talking about intentional weight loss, I want to first start by validating your sense that it is in conflict with intuitive eating, and that those are two decidedly different things. When I'm talking about intentional weight loss, I'm not talking about eating intuitively. And when I'm talking about eating intuitively, I'm not talking about doing it for intentional weight loss. So I think it's important that that is clarified. So when I'm talking about, when I am talking about intuitive eating, I'm not talking about it in terms of, like, I always like to make the distinction. There's intuitive eating, like the cultural movement that really started with the book called Intuitive Eating, Evelyn Triboli, who wrote the book, and the 10 principles of intuitive eating. They, operationalized it. And that's one version of intuitive eating. That's not ever really what I'm talking about, because I think my opinion on that, in short, is that it was a really great first step. It's a really great step out of diet culture conditioning. And we need to do a lot of those things and follow those 10 principles. But when I'm talking about intuitive eating, I'm not talking about their 10-step method of it. I'm talking about intuitive eating, like eating intuitively, yeah. like really listening to your body, you know? And I think, to me, an important distinction around that is, or my opinion around that is, when I'm talking about intuitive eating, I'm really talking about intuitive eating connected to, like I said earlier, you're a spiritual being having a physical experience. So if we're talking about intuitive eating, we're not just talking about eat when you're hungry, stop when you're full, listen to your body. What we're talking about is you are a spiritual being and your soul is living in your body. Your body is your home. And so you listening to your body is way more than hunger and fullness. You listening to your body is like your intuition. Your intuition. We want to talk about intuitive eating. We have to get the intuition online. And so I think for me, intuitive eating, I'm putting that in quotes, is way deeper and way more profound and way more, frankly, a spiritual approach than just about food and eating and hunger and fullness. This is like, listen to your body, your authentic feelings, your feelings, your visions, your purpose, your opinions, your sense, your, you know, energy, vibes. Like, that's the intuition I'm talking about that we all have as animals.
There's a theme that's kind of been weaved throughout like your last 15 or so episodes. I don't know if you've actually said the phrase, but the thing that kept coming, like kept spinning in my brain, was being able to come to a conclusion that a change of your body is more of an act of self-love as opposed to like self-betrayal. I don't know if you actually said something like that. That's what keeps coming to me. And then I want to use that as a conduit into still, and you might know what I'm talking about, but still, other than the podcast episode that I did with Howard Schubiner, it's my favorite podcast episode anybody's done with anybody. And it's one that you did a couple of years ago. And I'll bury the lead because I want to talk a little bit more in depth about that. But I guess talk about like weight loss or intentional weight loss in particular as an act of self-love rather than maybe how it's traditionally thought of, which is like, I got to lose 20 pounds. And there's not, you know, it's different. Like, I did competitive weightlifting. There were weight cuts involved. Actually, my middle school daughter, she wants to try wrestling, like middle school wrestling next year. And we met the coach. Coach is a great guy. He did make a comment where I was like, where he said, we're going to need an 81, meaning an 81 pound female wrestler. And she's like an 88 or an 89. And as we walked away from that, I was thinking, she's like a pole right now. And it's hard for me to she didn't understand what it meant. Like, but part of me was like, ooh, I don't love the idea of a seventh grade girl thinking that she's got to lose 7 pounds in order to make a weight cut for wrestling. That's a little bit spun off of this idea of self-love rather than self-betrayal. But I guess talk about like intentional weight loss or dieting or whatever synonym we want to use.
Yeah.
Where you're doing it as an act of self-love, like I deserve this versus I need to lose 10 or 20 pounds.
Yeah. Well, I think the important thing about, you know, the way that you phrase it, saying intentional weight loss is out of self-love rather than, you know, self-loathing, for example, is the only thing I would add to that is that it can be. I'm not saying that it is or that it isn't. What I'm saying is that some of the time it can be. And I think that is like decidedly the nuance that I want to insert into this conversation, is that if someone is intentionally losing weight, it can be from a place of self-love. as much as it can be from a place of self-loathing. I don't know, looking at the person on the surface, I don't know without having a conversation with them. But that's kind of the point, is that instead of looking at all intentional weight loss as this person must hate themselves or this person must be unhappy with themselves, there's another narrative that's like, well, actually, that isn't always the case, or it doesn't always need to be the case. And so this is coming from someone who used to be over 300 pounds. And so what I think about is like, I don't know if you've seen this, but this it's a picture, an image where it's kind of like this is hard to explain, but it's like a person carving out a thinner body from a bigger one. And so it's kind of like this person is holding like the chisel in their own hand, and what they're carving out is like a thin, like kind of sculpted body out of like a morbidly obese body, and you can like see it. And so I remember, and I know that I've shared this image before. I've shared it at retreats. I've shared it on Instagram, mostly because I'm just curious, when I share that image, how do people feel? And some people, like when I saw that the first time I saw it, I felt so seen, because I remember feeling I was over 300 pounds. I was 17 years old. And my experience of intentional weight loss, even back then, when it was very extreme and unhealthy and rooted in diet culture and all of the, you know, I started at Jenny Craig. So you want to hear more about that? You can listen to the story on my podcast. But, you know, it's like, even then, when I was intentionally losing weight, the way that it felt to me was like I was buried under like hundreds of pounds of like rubble, and I was slowly but surely clearing it out of the way. I felt like I was crawling into the hole and digging myself out. I was getting myself out of something that felt like a trap of some, like I felt like I was buried underneath my body, and intentional weight loss was me coming out. And so when I saw that image, I was like, that is what it felt like. You know, I can move, I can breathe, I can walk up a flight of stairs. I am not getting stress fractures in my feet from just existing. Yeah. I felt like I was saving myself and helping myself. And so some people see an image like that and get really upset, you know, and it's like, this image suggests that all fat people should be thin, or that underneath all fat people, or inside all fat people, is a thin person dying to come out, and it's fat phobic and it's thin privilege. And it's like, I get that. I understand that based on your experiences, that's how it feels. And that's valid. And so that's kind of the whole point, is like, depending on the body you're in, the relationship you have with the body that you're in, it can come from self-love as much as it can come from self-loathing. And you don't get to tell me what it is for me, the same way I don't get to tell you what it is for you.
How do people's result, because people do think of those couple of things differently, and they may arrive, let's say that it is a, let's just keep the numbers simple. It's a woman that's, it's two women, 150 pounds each. They both want to get to, let's say, 120 or 130. One sort of does it as this, I need to lose 20 pounds, and is kind of taking it from a place of control. And the other person is taking it more from the perspective that you just spoke about, which is like, it's more in a, like a fierce self-compassion. They both may arrive, you know, whenever the finish line happens, and they both may arrive at 130 pounds. Which approach is likely to last, and why?
Great question. The loving, safe approach is sustainable. Here's why. Because, like I said earlier, you have an animal brain. So if you're coming from a place of coercion and control and feeling insecure, let's look at something like the feelings wheel. I love the feelings wheel. Anyone listening to this, go to feelingswheel.com and you can see what I'm talking about. So if you're driven by, for example, insecurity, inadequacy, I'm not good enough, you'll see on the feelings wheel, those are all part of fear. And so the same way that you can run from a predator, you can run from a predator. You just can't run from a predator forever. You can't run from a predator for the rest of your life. Is the same way that you can be driven by fear, but it's not sustainable. You could change your body from that place, but you know, like something John Gabriel used to say all the time is like, then it's like holding a volleyball underwater. Is like you have to use that energy of like coercion and fear,
yep,
to maintain it. Whereas like for me, and this is another just important distinction, when you like earlier when you say like dieting, intentional weight loss, whatever you want to call it, to me those are like two very decidedly different things. Where and I posted a lot of videos about this last year when I first started doing this, of how do we intentionally lose weight in a way that's not dieting. And so the reason I'm saying that is because if I'm taking a loving approach, what that means is that it's gentle, it's flexible, it's gradual. So I never had a goal weight. I never had a timeline. I never had any of those things. And so what that allows me to do is embody the energy of safety, is that I'm working toward a goal. Sure. I want things to be different. Sure. I'm changing things. Sure. Fierce self-compassion is taking action to alleviate suffering. But at the same time, the reason that it's decidedly different than dieting or anything rooted in fear and control is because I'm perfectly okay the way I am right now. I don't need my body to change. I would like my body to change, but hey, whatever, who cares? And so part of that is like, for example, a specific example is like when I went on vacation, I remember I went to Aruba actually around this time last year. And I remember being like, I'm decidedly going out to this dinner and eating all this food and drinking these cocktails. And I know that I'm putting myself in a caloric surplus, and that is not consistent with the goal of intentional weight loss. And the reason that I'm choosing to do that is because I'm an Aruba and yeah. I want to. And yep. So like, it's flexible, you know, it's spontaneous. There's room for spontaneity and life. And so that is, again, decidedly different than dieting, but you can probably feel energetically with the energy of safety, acceptance, peace, freedom. I'm allowed to do what I want. I have all the choice and power here. I don't have to do anything. The stakes are so low. You know, that's the other thing I kept talking about in my podcast is like, when I had the thought of like, what if I gain it all back? You know, what if I fail? The reaction to that was like, so what? Yeah. So what? You know, you're in a healthy place right now. So what? It would make no difference. And that's safety. You change something, it's safe. You stay where you are, nothing changes, it's also safe. And that is what makes it sustainable. It's the great paradox of change, always.
It's almost like you stole my thunder, so thanks a lot. But the podcast that I was talking about was June 9th, 2024. You interviewed John Gabriel. And I went back and I listened maybe 2 weeks ago. And it still hit me just like it did before. One of the things you opened that with, and I'm going to link to it in the show notes so that people can go back and listen. I think it's fantastic. You had pointed out that, hey, when I first met you, I thought you were a total jerk, or maybe when I first, like there was something, yeah. You're not back in that place where you think that the message is bad, right? Like I can speak about the things that really resonate. Okay. I thought so. Cause you just mentioned him, but, something that really spoke to me in that, I don't even remember exactly what it was that he said, but I remember exactly where I was walking. This was 2 years ago. I remember exactly where I was walking. I remember exactly how it made me feel. And for the longest time, as like I was a competitive weightlifter, and I haven't done any of that. Mostly my stuff now is like, it's all recreational. You know, I play like softball in the summer, and then I coach soccer, and then like, I want to be able to ride my motorcycle, and to be able to do that in the way to which I do it in the woods and all that stuff, I need to be able to be athletic and I need to be able to be agile. Something about the way that you and John spoke about weight loss in general, resonated, where the messaging to myself flipped to become, maybe change some of your habits because you deserve better. Like that was just the message that spoke to me. And like that, like, and I just snapped my fingers. I don't know if Mike picked it up, but the stuff that I ate changed immediately. And it became much more of this, when I say plant-based priority. Like, that doesn't mean that vegan or vegetarian or whatever. He was talking about vegetables or fruits or whatever. But that's just where, like, if I have a big ass plate and most of my meals, it is a enormous plate and there is food all over it. Like, it's spilling off the side. So it's not like traditionally anytime that I had tried to lose weight, you know, I'm using the scale and I'm counting and I'm doing all this. And a lot of the portions are smaller. This was the first time where I had never, I just said, like, you know, screw the idea of portions. And instead I'm going to change to whatever I think is going to make me feel better, perform better, but ultimately, like, give me the greatest edge because I deserve it. And everything was comma, I deserve it. And what I noticed was a lot of times when I'm like dieting, if I was trying to get down 5 or 10 pounds for a competition, it was agonizing and it took a long time. And I typically went to bed pretty hungry, or I'd be starving in the morning because I'd be trying to backload all my calories to the end of the day, like my calories, right? In listening to you and John talk, the change was basically like my diet largely became a ton of fruits, a ton of vegetables, typically like between 5 and 7 of each of those per day. And then protein would balance the plate. And like, I mean, I lost 25 pounds faster than I ever have in my entire, like, they, it just, everything just melted off. And some of that could be because a lot of fruits and vegetables are largely water. And so that's probably a part of it. I was always full. I remember, as I would have 3 of these meals per day, plus all the snacks that I would want, is, you know, they're fruit and vegetables, but they're stuff that feels good to me. Like, I love a good apple, I love a good orange, I love it, depending on the time of year, a lot of the seasonal stuff I try to have. And I was like, no freaking, I would just weigh in on Thursday mornings, like, no way I'm going to be less now. And I'd be like 7 pounds down. I'm like, what? And I got into this like incredible shape for all the summer sports that I was doing. And I don't know. It's interesting because a 1-hour conversation between Lisa and John, and again, I listened to it a couple weeks ago, allows me to lock in faster than anything else. So I don't know what comes to mind when I talk about that stuff, or if you can even think back to the interview about that. But does anything come to mind when I speak, when I go on a diatribe like that about what I just did?
Of course. Does anything come to mind, Eddie? Well, first of all, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. That's so powerful to hear. And I'm so happy for you. I had no idea. Yes. Okay. Well, you know what? To me, what comes to mind primarily is really a reflection of course, like where I am right now, a conversation I've been having a lot, some of what I'm starting to integrate into my own podcast episodes, is that it really is this blend of what's going on mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and what's going on physically. And so to me, what you're talking about is you had a mindset shift. And now things became, right, it's not that you have to or that you're not good enough if you don't or all of that, or, you know, the agonizing story. But again, because if we look at the energy of the thoughts that we carry, a lot of the way that you had done it in the past, if you feel into your body as you're telling yourself, you can't eat this, you only have this many calories, it's like limited, it's scarcity, it's not enough, it's fear, it's the energy of fear. You can feel that. And so when you start to shift it, because a mindset shift also carries an energetic shift, that is, I deserve it. I deserve more. I want more for myself. I want better for myself. This is self-love. This is self-care. This is staying committed to something. This is aligning with something. Energetically, your body is experiencing that. We are mind-body creatures, right? So it's not just that you had a different thought, it's that the thought now carries a different energy and a different feeling. So your whole body's in a different state while you're doing it, which is partially why you get on the scale and you're like, wait, what? I didn't even think, like, I thought I had to suffer for this, right? So, but to me, all of that is like the foundation of then implementing something different in the physical dimension, which is what actually got the number on the scale to shift. You actually were eating more fruits and vegetables. You were eating high volume, but you were eating lower calorie. So you saw a weight shift on the scale. And that to me is what this is like about, is where I had a conversation with a client yesterday who is also familiar with kind of like the mind-body approach. And we were talking about how what I've seen and what I have done personally, but what I've seen in many of my clients, we swing the pendulum. So there's the diet to anti-diet swing of the pendulum, but that's not the pendulum I'm talking about. In this context, I'm talking about the everything is physical side of the pendulum. So when we have potentially symptoms of chronic pain, it's like doctors, injections, medications, surgeries, or everything is physical. And then we discover the mind-body connection and realize that actually some of the time there's like an emotional genesis to it. And then we swing the pendulum. And now not everything is physical. Everything is emotional. Everything is emotional, so much so that I forget I have a body that I'm living in and that my body actually needs to be taken care of. And I have physical needs that need to be met. And so if I'm going to function well, I have to be fed. I have to be hydrated. I need rest. Like, we have a physical body that needs taken care of. And so when it comes to something like intentional weight loss in my world, what I'm having to say, and that's where a lot of my podcast episodes are going right now, is like, what I have to explicitly say is you can do all of the mental, emotional, spiritual work around your relationship with food and eating in your body, but we have to integrate this into the physical dimension. And so that's the part that for you in this anecdote, all of that was happening. It's not like you said, I changed my mindset and then the number on the scale changed, which is what a lot of people expect to happen. That is, I'll do all the inner emotional work. I'll be really kind and compassionate to myself. And then the scale will shift, won't it? And it's like, not if you can be, and I think I said this literally verbatim on my last episode, which is like, you can be as compassionate to yourself as you want. But if you are eating in a caloric surplus, you're not going to lose weight. And so it has to be both. We have to marry what is going on internally with what is going on externally. There has to be some awareness and, dare I say, potentially accountability around, like, what are you eating every day? And where are the numbers around that? And that's why I also said, you know, in I think my latest podcast episode, what I love about the physical dimension and specifically weight training, like I said, like dumbbells, not like weight on the body, is like the physical dimension doesn't lie. Math is math. Science is science. And so when it comes to something like intentional weight loss, we do have to consider the mindset, the energy, the emotions. We have to talk about the relationship you have with yourself, all of that, if we want it to be sustainable. I am here for the spiritual approach, but we also can't do it without numbers and data. This is physics at the end of the day. And the problem is that we don't know how to be in relationship with that in a way that feels safe, because every time we started looking at numbers, it was, you know, Weight Watchers or our mother or the dietitian who was really mean to us and said we couldn't have Coke or whatever, yeah, when we were 8 years old. Hi. You know, so anyway, it's about all of that at once.
Saw a TikTok.
Does that make sense?
It makes me think. I saw a TikTok ad the other day, or not an ad. It was a video where somebody had taken a commercial from like 1991 or 1992 for Slim Fast and played it on there. And I'm amazed at the language that was used. That makes me think of, you know, the 8 year old, you can't have soda kind of thing. There was a, and I haven't listened to this episode yet. It was a couple episodes ago, maybe just give a teaser because I think the series is really cool. One of the titles on it, it caught my eye and I need to listen to it. And actually the plan was I was going to listen to it walking the dogs today. And then one of my kids got a injury and so I had to drive her ass to school instead of making her walk like I always do. One of them was called The Internalized Male Gaze. What is that?
Oh yeah.
And am I going to find this insulting as a male or no? Am I going to be okay?
No, I think you'll find it validating in a lot of ways, honestly, because, okay, so the internalized male gaze is essentially the internalization of the outsider gaze. We don't have to limit it to the male gaze, but that's the, you know, in the research, there are studies and in, you know, in the literature, that's what we'll call it. But it's not just the male gaze, it's the outside gaze. And what that is, you know, if you ever find yourself potentially, let's say sitting at home, sitting on your couch, sitting in your bed, and then all of a sudden you start like fixing yourself to look good. And then you realize that there is no audience. There's no one there. You're not being seen by anyone. And the whole point of me talking about the internalized male gaze, honestly, anyone who's listening to this, like, go over and listen to those episodes, because I can't do it justice in like a few minutes, but it's really, really, really good, very powerful stuff. But the idea is, if we are, if we've internalized, and this is especially for women, because we live in a patriarchal society where we have been taught how to move, breathe, and dress and laugh in a certain way, to, you know, get attention and in some ways feel safe in this society. But we've internalized the outside gaze, the outside audience that isn't actually there. But the reason I'm talking about it is because we have to look at, we have to look at it in general, because a lot of people don't know that this is happening and are not familiar with it. And it's subconscious. And so we have to pay attention to it, because what is it doing to our posture? What's it doing to our body language? What's it doing to our physiology? And like I said in my podcast, what is it doing to your breath? Because just to give you an example, a lot of people that I've worked with, and again, I've experienced this myself, is we might feel afraid because we have been so conditioned that fat is bad. We might be so afraid of taking a deep breath using diaphragmatic breathing, which will communicate safety to the mind-body system. We are afraid to do that and resistant to doing that because we will, what will happen if we take a deep breath? Our belly will rise and fall, and we will feel fat. And so what that means is, if I've been so conditioned to go as far away from fat as I can, what that means is now I'm not even breathing into my belly. And I'm over here wondering why I have digestive issues. I'm not even taking a deep breath. But that's not happening in a vacuum. That's not happening out of nowhere. That's happening because we feel afraid to fill up our diaphragm and actually breathe. And so we have to be aware of the hidden, silent forces that have us breathing, walking, talking, existing in a way that we are on a physiological level. Because if we want to take our power back from that and actually be embodied as first step, like the first step to sustainable weight loss is feeling safe in your body as it is. It's the great paradox of it all. But if we are not even taking deep breaths because someone else might be judging us by the way we look, we've got to incorporate all that. We have to integrate all that and become aware of all of that. So that's why I'm talking about the internalized male gaze, because we have to, I think. But the reason I want to tell you, I got a text from one of my male friends who's making his way through the solo series too. And it was so powerful, because what he texted me was, I didn't realize how much I have been conditioned by the male gaze also, because you're talking about your posture being one way because men might be looking at you as a female, but I am finding myself posturing myself to feel more macho because I have to show up in the world. And so I'm getting texts from him every few days like, oh my God, my breath. Like, when I pay attention to my breathing and I can let my body relax a little bit, I actually am feeling a difference in my digestion, in my pain, in my this, in my that. And it's like, so it's not just the male gaze, and it's not about men. It's about the fact that we are conditioned to essentially internalize the outside audience, and that affects our body language, and it affects our relationship with ourselves and food and presence and everything.
There's a video of Jamie Lee Curtis from 4 years ago that this makes me think about, where she had talked about that she had been clenching. I'm reading some of this stuff, but she had been clenching her stomach since she was 11, and she's in her 60s when she did this interview, and that she has now made a conscious effort to, I'm just not sucking in my, like, posture wise I'm not sucking in my belly anymore. And she had said that, like, the letting go of that need to conceal her body made her feel more free, both physically and creatively. And I'm guessing because you lower the stakes when you're not constantly in a, the male friend saying that is an interesting thing, because yes, like, a lot of us walk around, we try to make our shoulders look bigger than they are. We try to just generally look, yes, tougher, like we're going to go fucking fight a tiger, when usually it's like, if we're in sales, we're going to make a couple cold calls, or if we're, you know, like,
right.
That's generally what we're really trying to posture for are things in their everyday life when, you know, internally, I think our amygdala is probably saying like, oh, protect, 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 when it isn't necessarily needed.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Thank you for sharing that.
Hey, we're quite a bit over, but I want to thank you for being here. I was thinking one last thing I was thinking about. You may not even remember this, but I realized the time that June 9th, John Gabriel episode and how much it hit me. And 4 weeks later, my family we were stuck and sort of trapped in this like series of explosions with a bunch of these fireworks. And when I went back to the explosion site the next morning, I had said, hey, can I need to ask you about something. I sent you, and then I just sent you this, the world's longest voice note, and I was crying and all this. And I think you're the only person that I sent that to. And I think the reason mm-hmm. was because she had this, she spoke about this thing. It really landed with me. I trust her with this kind of stuff. So thank you for the stuff you're doing and the things that you talk about and the authenticity that you bring to the microphone, but in the things that you write and all that stuff too. And as always, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that too.
Okay. Don't hang up the phone. I'm going to press stop, but, where can people find you?
Okay. Outofthecave.health is the website. Lisa.Schlagram, the Out of the Cave podcast on Spotify and Apple, and lisaschlossberg@gmail.com if you want to just slide right into my inbox.
Awesome. Have a great rest of the week. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.